Hello, everyone. I want to welcome you to the Free Man Beyond the Wall podcast. This is your host, Mance Rader. This is episode 115. It's going to go up on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, eBooks, YouTube, on my website, freemanbeyondthewall.com. If you go into the episode section, there is a link to a podcast website that I've started to use instead of my main website. I want to remind you about my book, The Kids Are Not All Right. Check it out on Amazon, and it is also available on my main website, freemanbeyondthewall.com/store. And there you can get both of my books, The Kids Are Not All Right and Freedom Through Memedom, and you can get them using 8 different kinds of cryptocurrency. I'm happy to provide that. I'm really excited about it. I actually got that site going live yesterday, and already somebody's bought a book using cryptocurrency. It's really exciting to me. I think from some of the previous podcasts, you know how excited I am about cryptocurrency and still learning about it. For those of you who love crypto, I hope you would take advantage of getting my books. Just leave a note. I will sign it, endorse it any way you want. So today, I am welcoming Professor Alex Vitali to the show. He is a professor of sociology and coordinator of the Policing and Social Justice Project at Brooklyn College, and he is the author of The End of Policing. We're going to talk a little bit about how we got to the violent state of modern policing. We're going to talk about the history of policing, and we're going to talk about some solutions. So, without any further delay, here is Professor Alex Vitali. I'm here with Dr. Alex Vitali. You are a professor at Brooklyn College, is that correct?
That's right.
All right. What are some of your credentials include the great book that we're going to be talking about on this podcast?
Sure. So I'm a sociologist here at Brooklyn College, and I run a research center here called the Policing and Social Justice Project. And I've been working on policing issues since the early 90s, over 25 years now, both as an advocate and an academic. And I've worked with police departments and human rights groups around the world, write reports, do research, publish in the academic journals, and I have a new book called The End of Policing from Verso Press.
I see that on the cover of the book, it says, "The problem is not police training, police diversity, or police methods. The problem is the dramatic and unprecedented expansion and intensity of policing in the last 40 years, a fundamental shift in the role of police in society. The problem is policing itself." How did we get here?
Right. So I think we've seen a big shift over the last 40, 45 years in the role of policing. Now, you know, some of the problems with policing are hundreds of years old and speak very deeply about fundamental inequalities in our society. But in the 1960s and 70s, we begin to see this expansion of a kind of punitive turn. And by that, we often mean the rise of incarceration rates, the increases in the federal role in law enforcement, the expansion of the scope and intensity of police power, everything from the creation of SWAT teams to the massive expansion in the number of police in schools, the war on drugs, broken windows policing. All these things have really expanded the role of police in ways that I think are deeply problematic.
Is there something in your past, somebody that you know, an acquaintance, a family member who has been affected by this kind of policing?
Well, no, not in that sort of direct sense. I mean, I had my own run-ins with the law, as they say, as a young person, and you know, but I wasn't like I had some unusual or particularly horrible experience. I didn't start off to study policing or work on policing issues. I actually did my undergraduate work in urban studies and cultural anthropology and was interested in economic development, community development kinds of projects, and when I got out of school, eventually started working at a homeless coalition doing housing policy. And what happened was is that so many of the folks that we were working with who were homeless or formerly homeless were really complaining about an uptick in police harassment. And my boss asked me to look into it, and that turned out to be the early stages of broken windows policing. And so I just over time got drawn into that because it's become such a central feature of urban political dynamics.
You're at Brooklyn College now. Are you a native New Yorker?
I'm not. I've been here in Brooklyn for 25 years, but I grew up in Houston, and I've lived in California and in Massachusetts for a number of years.
Do you, okay, those places, you talk about Houston, Massachusetts, California. Do you see, now I'm a native New Yorker, I'm from the Bronx, and mm-hmm. I grew up there, I left as an adult. Do you see the policing in New York City, using that example, as being different than the other cities that you've had experiences in?
Well, all cities have their unique qualities about policing, and in a sense, there's a lot of innovation in American policing because every police department has its own local leadership. But I think in broad terms, there are a lot of similarities in policing, and that is that, you know, there's an intensive focus on the management of poor and non-white populations. And that the response to crime problems is to intensify policing. And some departments, you know, use more so-called evidence-based methods. Some, you know, have quotas. Some do more, in quotes, community policing. But I think by and large, the similarities outweigh the differences.
So you've been in New York for 25 years. So You arrived, I would assume, just as the Giuliani was ramping up the attacks on the homeless and panhandlers, things like that. Is that when you arrived there?
That's right. The summer of 93. So just before, you know, Giuliani gets elected that fall, takes office in the winter, and then really doesn't begin to adopt all of these policies until really 94, 95. So yes, and it was very similar to what I had already witnessed in San Francisco, which elected its chief of police mayor on a broken windows oriented platform of, you know, getting rid of public homelessness and clamping down on public disorder.
Yeah, using the police.
Using
a legal method to solve a social problem.
That's
which
right.
Which is basically, okay. Can you go over, I know in your book, you go over in length the history of policing in this society and where it came from, the origins. Can you talk a little bit about obviously we don't have time for the whole thing, but
yeah.
what you see in the origins of policing in this society that have carried over to the worst parts of policing today?
So the reason this is important is because a lot of the conversation about policing today centers around a kind of liberal discourse of trying to perfect policing and under the assumption that the police are kind of the neutral agents of law enforcement and that the neutral and professional enforcement of the law is inherently liberatory. And so the liberal history of policing always begins with the London Metropolitan Police in 1829, who are held out as the first sort of modern professional police force, who are, you know, policing by consent and, you know, not as violent as the militia or the army had been and, you know, tied to the rule of law. But what that history always leaves out is where that idea came from. And it comes from Sir Robert Peel, Robert, Bob, the Bobbies. But before he invented the Bobbies, he was actually in charge of the British colonial occupation of Ireland, where he develops these new forms of policing to more efficiently manage the exploitation of Irish agricultural workers, to put down revolts more efficiently than using the military, who were off fighting Napoleon. In the U.S., we had our own form of colonial policing, which was the Texas Rangers. And there were similar bodies in places like St. Louis and even Los Angeles, semi-professional militias initially, but who eventually become full-fledged law enforcement organizations whose job it was to drive off or exterminate the indigenous populations, to displace Mexican landowners, to make way for white colonial settlement. There's also been a tremendous back and forth between colonial forms and other forms of policing. So the first state police force in the United States was the Pennsylvania State Police, formed in 1905. They were created to suppress miners and other industrial workers in Pennsylvania, and the model for that state police force was the U.S. occupation forces in the Philippines, and there was a direct transfer of personnel and technology. And then another important precursor of modern policing are slave patrols, but not so much the rural kind we think about, you know, running onto plantations, but actually urban slave patrols that are managing mobile slave populations that work outside the home of their owners in wharves and warehouses, factories, etc. And so the Charleston City Watch and Guard, by the late 1700s, really looks like a fully modern police force with uniforms, full-time jobs, tied to law enforcement, 24-hour availability, but their primary job is managing mobile slave populations. So we need to understand that policing has always existed as a tool for managing profound inequalities and systems of producing inequality and pushing back against the resistance to that, those processes of exploitation.
So what we see today, the you talk about how it's really only been 40 or 50 years where we see SWAT teams coming into existence. We see, you know, basically, I think they've said that, I've read numbers that home incursions by police have gone up 50, you know, SWAT team calls have gone up 70%, you know, since the 70s. And, you know, then we have the no-knock warrants, things like that. How did all of these things come out of the, how would you talk about inequality in the past, and the police being used to regulate that? How does that come into the modern day?
So, first of all, a great research has been done on this by Peter Kraska at Eastern Kentucky University. And he's really documented this rise of SWAT teams. And the first SWAT teams created in Los Angeles basically to suppress the Black Panther Party. And the very first SWAT deployment in the United States was a raid on a Black Panther house in Los Angeles. And so SWAT was a way of placing local police at the center of debates about how to respond to the radical movements of the 1960s and early 70s. And what Parker, who was head of the LAPD, wanted was to see a muscular, militarized response, not a response of social inclusion and, you know, political openness and reform. So he creates these SWAT teams to give local government greater capacity to repress these social movements as opposed to try to negotiate with them and to come to some political accommodation. The reality is that they're, you know, after the early 70s, there's very little for these SWAT teams to do. An occasional barricaded suspect, an occasional bank robbery. But they continue to pour tons of money into these things for symbolic reasons and political reasons. And because they have nothing else to do, there's been this huge mission creep. So that now SWAT teams are routinely deployed for like low-level drug warrants, people who haven't paid their traffic ticket, you know, just all kinds of nonsense, even regular patrol duties. And these units are responsible for a tremendous abuse of authority, excessive use of force, unnecessary injuries and deaths, and they rarely are needed to face truly, you know, armed and dangerous suspects.
I was thinking while you were talking about that, have you done any study on Ruby Ridge and Waco?
I have not done any study on it. I mean, I'm certainly familiar with those incidents. I mean, Waco is a great example of totally misguided policing because they knew that David Koresh went out jogging on a regular basis. And if they wanted to grab him up, they could easily have, you know, placed a van on a road that he regularly jogged on and just made a simple arrest. Instead, it seemed that they wanted to have this kind of showdown with the folks in the compound there that, of course, led to these horrible, tragic outcomes. And this is often the case with these kinds of militarized, politicized forms of what is essentially political policing.
It's interesting that you use the term showdown there because that was actually called Operation Showtime.
Right.
Yeah,
that's
so
right. They wanted to send a message.
And they did.
Yes, of repressive capacity, but yes, it went a little bit awry.
So you in what I read earlier from the cover of your book, you say what we have now is just it can't be fixed. What's your answer? That's what it always comes down to when I'm out there criticizing a government policy, criticizing the government in general. The first response you always get from the people that are, you know, that love the policy or don't see a problem with it because maybe it hasn't affected them or they haven't thought about it is what is the answer? So what do you see as the solution?
So, the sort of main thesis of the book is that most of the police reforms that are being proposed now, implicit bias training, community policing, body cameras, are not going to work, are not going to change the basic nature of policing and the negative impact it has on communities. Instead, we need to dial back the mission of policing. Here in New York, we have more NYPD personnel in New York City schools than we have counselors of all varieties. The war on drugs has been a total failure by any possible measure. We just don't need police to do these things. Instead, we need restorative justice programs in schools and community schools models and better emotional, social, behavioral learning. We need to end the war on drugs, look at schemes of legalization, decriminalization, harm reduction approaches, etc. So in every chapter of the book, I take an area of policing, show why it's a problem, and then lay out what we could be doing instead of relying on police for that social function.
I have a friend who, he's a former police officer who now speaks out against policing. He's been on my podcast 4 times now. Whenever he comes on, he's always, everybody loves him. Because he did it and he realizes the damage that he did, especially in low income, he was actually in North Charleston. So, African American neighborhoods. One thing that he says, and something we talk about all the time is how these police officers can get brought up on charges and the grand jury won't bring charges against them or find them not guilty if they do make it to trial. And he says that the only, have you seen this in your research? He says that one of the main reasons is the only expert that they'll allow to come in there and testify is one who will come in there and say, this he was just following procedure. This is the exact procedure, so he cannot be blamed for what he's doing.
Yes, well, see, this is the limit of a strategy of police reform that's rooted in accountability as jailing killer cops. It's just not going to work. The legal frameworks for policing are incredibly permissive of police use of force. And district attorneys, grand juries, judges, and regular juries have been incredibly reluctant to hold police accountable criminally, and often because what they're doing is not actually against the law. And so some people have responded to this by trying to change the legal standard, to try to create local statutes that tighten up the standard, but I really am skeptical that this is going to work, because the institutions of the criminal justice system don't want police power to be reined in. Ultimately, they want police to be able to utilize that power and authority. And they see the inappropriate deaths and other violence as an unfortunate but unavoidable byproduct of a system of using police to manage the poor, socially marginal, etc. And it's just an unfortunate collateral consequence. And they don't want police not to be able to do that. So I think we have to get closer to the heart of the issue, is why do people want police to do these things? And we need to rethink what we mean by justice, and how much power do we want the state to have to kind of micro-regulate the lives of these people.
Well, it makes me think of, I don't know if you've seen the video over the weekend of I believe it was a 20-year-old woman, mother, on the beach in New Jersey. And yeah. She was suspected of being intoxicated, and she, you know, passed whatever test they wanted to give her there. And then they, you know, I guess they tried to escalate it, and you know, knowing that she was innocent, she resisted. You talked a little bit about juries. How have the people of this country allowed a class of enforcement to form that has rights that not only go beyond what I possess, rights that you have to, as soon as you take an oath and you wear a uniform, apparently you have rights that are beyond everyone else. But how did we get to the point where they can disrespect you all day, we can't disrespect them, they can lie to us, it's illegal to lie to them. Is it hero worship? Have we been brainwashed into believing that, you know, I grew up in the Bronx, and I was basically told, look, if you have any interaction with these guys, just shut up. Don't say anything. They will take any chance to abuse you. And that's the way it was in the neighborhood that I grew up in. That's what we were told. So it wasn't so much of a respect as it was a fear. How did we get to the point where we just accept this?
Well, I think part of it is that, you know, there have been these historical shifts that have created much greater levels of economic insecurity in the U.S. And this really begins in the 1970s, I would argue. And we have responded to that economic security not by rebuilding a kind of social safety net or regulating markets in a particular way. Instead, we've turned that over to policing and prisons to manage. And so with that has come an ideology that views problematic behavior as the result of moral failure, and that this moral failure will only respond to authoritarian methods. And so if we want to really dial back the intensity and extent of policing in the society, we have to directly push back against these moralizing frameworks around drugs, alcohol, sex work, even, you know, youthful violent behavior, et cetera. Yes, some of these behaviors can produce problems or harms, but they're not questions of morality. They're questions of social dynamics. And we need more effective ways to deal with those social dynamics, and authoritarianism is rarely the most successful and almost never the most just way to address these things. So we need to have these bigger discussions about what we mean by justice and what the obligations of the state and individuals are to each other in kind of managing social life in less authoritarian ways.
I want to thank you for the time you've given. I know you're busy. I know you're speaking tomorrow. I wish I could be there for that. You're speaking in New York. It's in New York, right?
Yes, I'm speaking Thursday night in New York at the Verso Law, and I'm speaking Saturday afternoon at the Left Forum.
Awesome. Okay. One last question. I've argued, and a lot of people have argued, that a lot of neighborhoods would be better off. You know, we have these covenant communities all over the country. It's not a big thing in New York City, and I don't even know if there is one in New York City, but you know, I'm in the South, I'm in Georgia, and we have a lot of covenant communities, and you go in there and you sign, you basically agree to a whole bunch of rules. I've argued, a lot of people have argued over the years, that one of the best things that these communities could do, if communities would get together, is to hire private security, a security force that would be under their control, that if they went beyond the line that was drawn, they could always get another security force to come in there to do the job. More of a market kind of choice. Have you ever addressed that? Have you ever talked about that?
Yeah. So I'm not really a fan of sort of privatized policing or even micro local control of policing, because that really runs the risk of devolving into kind of parochial protectionism that can quickly become racialized, and that can involve the criminalization of outsiders who may not really be a threat, so that everyone from outside the community is automatically suspicious. And this just divides us up more. I think we need instead to talk about mechanisms of community empowerment. I think local communities matter. I think these local communities should have more self-determination, but that it should be in a positive direction. So that, you know, I remember an example where, as crack cocaine was becoming a big problem in the 80s and 90s, there were these neighborhoods where the city said, well, you have to take a drug treatment center, but the drug treatment center they had to take was like for heroin treatment. But they're like, we don't have a heroin problem in our community, we have a crack cocaine problem. So what you're doing is you're forcing a heroin treatment facility on us that's going to bring heroin users into the community, and yet you're still not dealing with our actual problem. So we need to talk to communities about what their problems are and develop tailored solutions for those communities. I just think that they should be positive looking. We need a better mental health infrastructure. We need more affordable housing. We need more after school programs for young people and pathways to real employment, things like that.
Okay, well, I appreciate it. Do you have, is there anything going beyond this week that you'd like to plug?
Sure. Well, people can go to my website, alex-vitali.info. I'll be in the Netherlands next week. Early August 8th, I'll be in Boston. I'm hoping to be in Austin later in the month of August. But if you go to my website or my Twitter feed at A Vitali, you can track my upcoming events.
Well, I really appreciate your time, Professor. Thank you very much. And when you leave the country, safe travels.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I want to thank you for tuning in to episode 115 of the Free Man Beyond the Wall podcast. I want to thank Professor Vitali for coming on today. I want to remind you that my books are available on my website, freemanbeyondthewall.com/store. You can buy them for 8 different cryptocurrencies. They're also available on Amazon if you want to use fiat. Thank you for tuning in and listening today. We'll be back in the middle of the week with another podcast. So take care, have a great week, and bye.